You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Chapter 20 of Fathers and Sons. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Roger Moline. Fathers and Sons by Ivan Turgenev. Translated by Richard Hare. Chapter 20. Bazarov leaned out of the tarantass, while Arkady stretched out his head from behind his companion's back, and saw standing on the steps of the little house a tall, thinnish man with ruffled hair and a sharp aquiline nose, dressed in an old military coat, not buttoned up. He stood with his legs wide apart, smoking a long pipe, and screwing up his eyes to keep the sun out of them. The horses stopped.
"Arrived at last!" exclaimed Bazarov's father, still continuing to smoke, though the pipe was fairly jumping up and down between his fingers. "Come! Get out! Get out! Let me hug you!"
He began embracing his son.
"Enyusha! Enyusha!" resounded a woman's quavering voice.
The door flew open, and on the threshold appeared a plump little old woman in a white cap and short colored jacket. She cried, staggered, and would probably have fallen if Bazarov had not supported her. Her plump little hands were instantly twined around his neck, her head was pressed to his breast, and there followed a complete hush, only interrupted by the sound of her broken sobs. Old Bazarov breathed hard and screwed up his eyes more than before.
"There, that's enough, enough, Arisha, leave off," he said, exchanging a look with Arkady, who remained standing motionless by the tarantass, while even the peasant on the box turned his head away. "That's quite unnecessary. Please leave off."
"Ah, Vasily Ivanitch," faltered the old woman, "for what ages, my dear one, my darling Enyushenka!"
And without unclasping her hands, she drew back her wrinkled face, wet with tears, and overwhelmed with tenderness, and looked at him with blissful and somehow comic eyes, and then again fell on his neck.
"Well, yes, of course, that's all in the nature of things," remarked Vasily Ivanitch. "Only we had better come indoors. Here's a visitor arrived with Evgeny. You must excuse this," he added, turning to Arkady and slightly scraping the ground with his foot. "You understand, a woman's weakness, and, well, a mother's heart."
His own lips and eyebrows were quivering, and his chin shook, but obviously he was trying to master his feelings and to appear almost indifferent. Arkady bowed.
"Let's go in, mother, really," said Bazarov, and he led the enfeebled old woman into the house.
He put her in a comfortable armchair, once more hurriedly embraced his father, and introduced Arkady to him.
"Heartily glad to make your acquaintance," said Vasily Ivanitch. "But you mustn't expect anything grand. We live very simply here, like military people. Arina Vlasyevna, pray calm yourself. What faint-heartedness! Our guest will think ill of you."
"My good sir," said the old woman through her tears, "I haven't the honor of knowing your name and your father's."
"Arkady Nikolaevich,"
interposed Vasily Ivanich solemnly, in a low voice.
"Excuse a foolish old woman like me."
She blew her nose, and bending her head from left to right, she carefully wiped one eye after the other.
"You must excuse me. I really thought I should die, that I should not live to see again my darling."
"Well, and here we have lived to see him again, madam," put in Vasily Ivanovich.
"Tanyushka,"
he said, turning to a bare-legged little girl of 13 in a bright red cotton dress, who was shyly peeping in at the door,
"bring your mistress a glass of water, on a tray, do you hear? And you, gentlemen,"
he added with a kind of old-fashioned playfulness,
"allow me to invite you into the study of a retired veteran." "Just once more let me embrace you, Anyushka,"
groaned Arina Vlasyevna. Bazarov bent down to her.
"Gracious, how handsome you've grown!"
"Well, I don't know about being handsome," remarked Vasily Ivanovich. "But he's a man, as the saying goes, homme fait. And now, I hope, Arina Vlasyevna, having satisfied your maternal heart, you will turn your thoughts to satisfying the appetites of our dear guests, because, as you know, even nightingales can't be fed on fairy tales." The old lady rose from her chair.
"This very minute, Vasily Ivanovich, the table shall be laid. I will myself run to the kitchen and order the samovar to be brought in. Everything will be ready, everything. Why, for 3 whole years I have not seen him, have not been able to give him food or drink. Is that nothing?"
"Well, you see to things, little hostess. Bustle about. Don't put us to shame. And you, gentlemen, I beg you to follow me. Here is Timofeitch come to pay his respects to you, Evgeny. And the old dog, I dare say he too is delighted. Aye, aren't you delighted, old dog? Be so good as to follow me." And Vasily Ivanovich went bustling ahead, shuffling and flapping with his down-at-heel slippers. His whole house consisted of 6 tiny rooms. One of these, the one into which he led our friends, was called the study. A thick-legged table, littered with papers blackened by an ancient accumulation of dust, as if they had been smoked, occupied the whole space between the 2 windows. On the walls hung Turkish firearms, whips, a saber, 2 maps, some anatomical diagrams, a portrait of Hufeland, a monogram woven out of hair in a blackened frame, and a diploma under glass. A leather sofa, torn and worn hollow in places, stood between 2 huge cupboards of Karelian birchwood. On the shelves, books, little boxes, stuffed birds, jars and vials were crowded together in confusion. In one corner lay a broken electric battery.
"I warned you, my dear guest," began Vasily Ivanovich, "that we live, so to speak, bivouacking."
"Now stop that. What are you apologizing for?" Bazarov interrupted.
"Kirsanov knows very well that we're not Croesuses and that you don't live in a palace. Where are we going to put him? That's the question."
"To be sure, Evgeny, there's an excellent room in the little wing. He will be very comfortable there."
"So you've had a wing built on?"
"Of course, where the bathroom is," put in Timofeitch.
"That is, next to the bathroom," Vasily Ivanovich added hurriedly. "It's summer now. I will run over there at once and arrange things. And you, Timofeitch, bring in their luggage meanwhile. Of course, I hand over my study to you, Evgeny. Tsuamsik."
"There you have him, a most comical old chap, and very good-natured," remarked Bazarov, as soon as Vasily Ivanovich had gone. "Just as queer a fish as yours, only in a different way. He chatters too much." "And your mother seems a wonderful woman," remarked Arkady.
"Yes, there's no humbug about her. You just see what a dinner she'll give us."
"They weren't expecting you today, sir. They've not brought any beef," observed Timofeich, who was just dragging in Bazarov's trunk.
"We shall manage all right, even without beef. You can't squeeze water from a stone. Poverty, they say, is no crime."
"How many serfs has your father?" asked Arkady suddenly.
"The property is not his, but mother's. There are 15 serfs, if I remember."
22 in all," added Timofeich in a dissatisfied tone. The shuffling of slippers was heard, and Vasily Ivanovich reappeared.
"In a few minutes your room will be ready to receive you," he exclaimed triumphantly. "Arkady, Nikolaich, I think that's how I should call you. And here is your servant," he added, indicating a boy with close-cropped hair, who had come in with him, wearing a long blue caftan with holes in the elbows, and a pair of boots which did not belong to him. "His name is Fedka. I repeat again, though my son has forbidden it, you must not expect anything grand. But this fellow knows how to fill a pipe. You smoke, of course?"
"I prefer to smoke cigars," answered Arkady.
"And you're quite right there. I like cigars myself, but in these remote parts it is extremely difficult to get them."
"Enough crying poverty," interrupted Bazarov. "You had better sit down on the sofa here and let us have a look at you." Vasily Ivanovich laughed and sat down. His face was very much like his son's, only his brow was lower and narrower, his mouth rather wider, and he never stopped making restless movements, shrugged his shoulders as though his coat cut him under the armpits, blinked, cleared his throat, and gesticulated with his fingers, whereas his son's most striking characteristic was the nonchalant immobility of his manner.
"Crying poverty," repeated Vasily Ivanovich. "You must suppose, Evgeny, that I want our guest, so to speak, to take pity on us by making out that we live in such a wilderness. On the contrary, I maintain that for a thinking man there is no such thing as a wilderness. At least I try, as far as possible, not to grow rusty, so to speak, not to fall behind the times."
Vasily Ivanovich drew out of his pocket a new yellow silk handkerchief, which he had found time to snatch up when he ran over to Arkady's room, and flourishing it in the air, he went on, "I am not speaking now of the fact that I, for instance, at the cost of quite considerable sacrifices to myself, have put my peasants on the rent system and given up my land to them in return for half the proceeds. I considered it my duty. Common sense alone demands that it should be done, though other landowners don't even think about doing it. But I speak now of the sciences, of education."
"Yes, I see you have here the Friend of Health for 1855, remarked Bazarov.
"That was sent me by an old comrade as a friendly gesture," Vasily Ivanovich hastily announced. "But we have, for instance, some idea even of phrenology," he added, addressing himself principally to Arkady, and pointing out a small plaster head on the cupboard, divided into numbered squares.
"Even Schönlein is not unknown to us, and Rademacher."
"Do people still believe in Rademacher in this province?" inquired Bazarov. Vasily Ivanovich cleared his throat.
"In this province, of course, gentlemen, you know better. How could we keep pace with you? You are here to take our places. Even in my time there was a so-called humoralist, Hoffman, and a certain Brown with his vitalism. They seemed very ridiculous to us, but they, too, had great reputations at one time.
Someone new has taken Rademacher's place with you. You bow down to him, but in another 20 years it will probably be his turn to be laughed at. For your consolation, I can tell you, said Bazarov, that we nowadays laugh at medicine altogether and bow down to nobody.
How do you mean? Surely you want to be a doctor?
Yes, but the one doesn't prevent the other. Vasily Ivanovich poked his middle finger into his pipe, where a little smoldering ash was left.
Well, perhaps, perhaps. I'm not going to dispute. What am I? A retired army doctor. Voilà tout. And now farming has fallen to my lot. I served in your grandfather's brigade. He addressed himself to Arkady again. Yes, yes, I have seen many sights in my time. And I mixed with every kind of society. I myself, the man you see before you, have felt the pulse of Prince Wittgenstein and of Zhukovsky. They were in the Southern Army, the 14th, you understand.
And here Vasily Ivanovich pursed his lips significantly.
I knew them all inside out. Well, well, but my work was only on one side. Stick to your lancet and be content. Your grandfather was a very honorable man and a real soldier.
Confess, he was a regular blockhead, remarked Bazarov lazily.
Ah, Evgeny, how can you use such an expression? Do consider. Of course, General Kirsanov was not one of those...
Well, drop him, interrupted Bazarov.
As I was driving along, I was pleased to see your birch plantation. It has sprung up admirably.
Vasily Ivanovich brightened.
And you must see the little garden I've got now. I planted every tree myself. I have fruit, raspberries, and all kind of medicinal herbs. However much you young gentlemen may know, old Paracelsus spoke the sacred truth. In herbis, verbis et lapidibus. I've retired from practice, as you know, but at least twice a week something happens to bring me back to my old work. They come for advice. I can't drive them away. And sometimes the poor people need help. Indeed, there are no doctors here at all. One of the neighbors here, a retired major, just imagine it, he doctors the people too. I ask the question, has he studied medicine? They answer, no, he hasn't studied. He does it more from philanthropy.
Ha ha! From philanthropy. What do you think of that?
Fedka, fill me a pipe, said Bazarov sternly. And there's another doctor here who had just visited a patient, continued Vasily Ivanovich in a kind of desperation. But the patient had already gone ad patres. The servant wouldn't let the doctor in and tells him, you're no longer needed. He never expected this, got confused, and asked, well, did your master hiccup before he died? Yes. Did he hiccup much? Yes. Ah, well, that's all right. And off he went again.
The old man laughed alone. Arkady managed to show a smile on his face. Bazarov merely stretched himself. The conversation continued in this way for about an hour. Arkady found time to go to his room, which turned out to be the anteroom to the bathroom, but it was very cozy and clean. At last Tanyushka came in and announced that dinner was ready. Vasily Ivanovich was the first to get up.
Come, gentlemen, you must pardon me generously if I have bored you. Maybe my good wife will give you better satisfaction.
The dinner, though hastily prepared, was very good and even abundant. Only the wine was not quite up to the mark. It was sherry, almost black, bought by Timofeich in the town from a well-known merchant, and it had a flavor of copper or resin. The flies also were a nuisance. On ordinary days, a serf boy used to keep driving them away with a big green branch. But on this occasion, Vasily Ivanovich had sent him away for fear of adverse criticism from the younger generation. Arina Vlasyevna had changed her dress, and was wearing a high cap with silk ribbons and a pale blue-flowered shawl. She started crying again as soon as she caught sight of her Enyusha, but her husband did not need to admonish her. She herself made haste to dry her tears in order not to spoil her shawl. Only the young men ate. The host and hostess had both dined long ago. Fedka waited at table, obviously encumbered by his unfamiliar boots. He was helped by a woman with a masculine cast of face and one eye, called Anfishushka. She fulfilled the duties of housekeeper, poultry woman, and laundress. Vasily Ivanovich walked up and down throughout the dinner, and with a perfectly contented and even blissful face, talked about the grave anxieties he had felt about Napoleon's policy and the complications of the Italian question. Arina Vlasyevna took no notice of Arkady, and did not press him to eat. Leaning her round face on her little fist, her full cherry-colored lips and the little moles on her cheeks and over her eyebrows, adding to her extremely kind, good-natured expression, she did not take her eyes off her son and constantly sighed. She was dying to know for how long he would stay, but she was afraid to ask him. "What if he stays for 2 days?" she thought, and her heart sank. After the roast, Vasily Ivanovich disappeared for a moment, and returned with an opened half-bottle of champagne. "Here," he exclaimed, "though we do live in the wilds, we have something to make merry with on festive occasions." He poured out 3 full glasses and a little wine-glass, proposed the health of our invaluable guests, and at once tossed off his glass in military fashion, and made Arina Vlasyevna drink her wine-glass to the last drop. When the time came for the sweet preserves, Arkady, who could not bear anything sweet, thought it his duty, however, to taste 4 different kinds which had been freshly made, all the more since Bazarov flatly refused them and began at once to smoke a cigar. Afterwards, tea was served with cream, butter, and rolls. Then Vasily Ivanovich took them all out into the garden to admire the beauty of the evening. As they passed a garden seat, he whispered to Arkady, "This is the spot where I love to meditate as I watch the sunset. It suits a recluse like me. And there, a little farther off, I have planted some of the trees beloved by Horace." "What trees?" asked Bazarov, overhearing. "Oh, acacias." Bazarov began to yawn. "I suppose it is time our travellers were in the embrace of Morpheus," observed Vasily Ivanovich. "In other words, it's time for bed," Bazarov interposed. "That's a correct judgment. It certainly is high time." Saying good night to his mother, he kissed her on the forehead while she embraced him, and secretly, behind his back, she gave him her blessing 3 times. Vasily Ivanovich showed Arkady to his room, and wished him as refreshing repose as I also enjoyed at your happy years. In fact, Arkady slept extremely well in his bathhouse. It smelt of mint, and 2 crickets behind the stove rivaled each other in their prolonged drowsy chirping. Vasily Ivanovich went from Arkady's room to his own study, and, settling down on the sofa at his son's feet, was looking forward to having a chat with him. But Bazarov sent him away at once, saying he felt sleepy, but he did not fall asleep till morning. With wide-open eyes, he stared angrily into the darkness. Memories of childhood had no power over him, and besides, he had not yet been able to rid himself of the impression of his recent bitter experiences. Arina Vlasyevna first prayed to her heart's content, then she had a long, long conversation with Antostushka, who stood rooted to the spot in front of her mistress, and, fixing her solitary eye upon her, communicated in a mysterious whisper all her observations and conjectures about Evgeny Vasilevich. The old lady's head was giddy with happiness, wine, and tobacco smoke. Her husband tried to talk to her, but with a wave of the hand he gave it up. Arina Vlasyevna was a genuine Russian lady of olden times. She ought to have lived 2 centuries before, in the ancient Moscow days. She was very devout and emotional. She believed in fortune-telling, charms, dreams and omens of every conceivable kind. She believed in the prophecies of crazy people, in house spirits, in wood spirits, in unlucky meetings, in the evil eye, in popular remedies. She ate specially prepared salt on Holy Thursday, and believed that the end of the world was close at hand. She believed that if on Easter Sunday the candles did not go out at Vespers, then there would be a good crop of buckwheat, and that a mushroom will not grow after a human eye has seen it. She believed that the devil likes to be where there is water, and that every Jew has a blood-stained spot on his breast. She was afraid of mice, of snakes, of frogs, of sparrows, of leeches, of thunder, of cold water, of drafts, of horses, of goats, of red-haired people, and of black cats. She regarded crickets and dogs as unclean animals. She never ate veal, pigeon, crayfish, cheese, asparagus, Jerusalem artichokes, hares, or watermelons, because a cut watermelon suggested the head of John the Baptist. She could not speak of oysters without a shudder. She enjoyed eating, but strictly observed fasts. She slept 10 hours out of the 24, and never went to bed at all if Vasily Ivanovich had so much as a headache. She had never read a single book, except Alexis or The Cottage in the Forest. She wrote 1 or at most 2 letters in a year, but she was an expert housewife, knew all about preserving and jam-making, though she touched nothing with her own hands, and was usually reluctant to move from her place. Arina Vlasyevna was very kind-hearted, and in her own way far from stupid. She knew that the world is divided into masters whose duty it is to command, and simple people whose duty it is to serve, and so she felt no disgust for servile behavior or bowing to the ground. But she treated affectionately and gently those in subjection to her, never let a single beggar go away empty-handed, and never spoke ill of anyone, though she was fond of gossip. In her youth she had been very pretty, had played the clavichord and spoken a little French, but in the course of many years of wandering with her husband, whom she had married against her will, she had grown stout and forgotten both music and French. Her son she loved and feared unutterably. She had handed over the management of her little estate to Vasily Ivanovich, and she no longer took any part in it. She would groan, wave her handkerchief, and raise her eyebrows higher and higher in horror directly her old husband began to discuss impending land reforms and his own plans. She was apprehensive, always expecting some great calamity, and would weep at once whenever she remembered anything sad. Nowadays such women have almost ceased to exist. God knows whether this should be a cause for rejoicing. End of chapter 20. Recording by Roger Moline. Chapter 21 of Fathers and Sons. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Roger Moline. Fathers and Sons by Ivan Turgenev. Translated by Richard Hare. Chapter 21. On getting up, Arkady opened the window, and the first object which met his eyes was Vasily Ivanovitch. In a Turkish dressing-gown tied round the waist with a pocket-handkerchief, the old man was zealously digging his kitchen garden. He noticed his young visitor, and leaning on his spade, he called out, "Good health to you! How did you sleep?" "Splendidly," answered Arkady. "And here I am, as you see, like some Cincinnatus, preparing a bed for late turnips. The time has come now, and thank God for it, when every one should secure his sustenance by the work of his own hands. It is useless to rely on others. One must labor oneself. So it turns out that Jean-Jacques Rousseau is right. Half an hour ago, my dear young sir, you could have seen me in an entirely different position. One peasant woman, who complained of looseness, that's how they express it, but in our language dysentery, I injected her with opium, and for another I extracted a tooth. I offered her an anesthetic, but she refused. I do all that gratis, animatur. However, I'm used to it. You see, I'm a plebeian, homo nu, not one of the old stock, not like my wife. But wouldn't you like to come over here in the shade and breathe the morning freshness before having tea?" Arkady went out to him. "Welcome once more," said Vasily Ivanovitch, raising his hand in a military salute to the greasy skull-cap which covered his head. "You, I know, are accustomed to luxury and pleasures, but even the great ones of this world do not disdain to spend a brief time under a cottage roof." "Gracious heavens!" protested Arkady, "as if I were a great one of this world! And I'm not accustomed to luxury either." "Pardon me, pardon me," replied Vasily Ivanovitch with an amiable grimace. "Though I am a back number now, I also have knocked about the world. I know a bird by its flight. I am something of a psychologist in my way, and a physiognomist. If I had not, I venture to say, been granted that gift, I should have come to grief long ago. A little man like me would have been blotted out. I must tell you without flattery, the friendship I observe between you and my son sincerely delights me. I have just seen him. He got up very early, as he habitually does, you probably know that, and ran off for a ramble in the neighborhood. Permit me to be so inquisitive. Have you known my Evgeny long?"
"Since last winter."
"Indeed. And permit me to question you further. But why shouldn't we sit down? Permit me as a father to ask you frankly, what is your opinion of my Evgeny?"
"Your son is one of the most remarkable men I have ever met," answered Arkady emphatically.
Vasily Ivanovitch's eyes suddenly opened wide, and a slight flush suffused his cheeks. The spade dropped from his hand.
"And so you expect," he began. "I'm convinced," interrupted Arkady, "that your son has a great future before him, that he will do honor to your name. I've felt sure of that ever since I met him."
How did it happen?" articulated Vasily Ivanovitch with some effort. An enthusiastic smile parted his broad lips and would not leave them.
"Would you like me to tell you how we met?"
"Yes, and all about it."
Arkady began his story, and spoke of Bazarov with even greater warmth,
even greater enthusiasm than he had done on that evening when he danced a mazurka with Madame Odintsov. Vasily Ivanovich listened and listened, blew his nose, rolled his handkerchief up into a ball with both hands, cleared his throat, ruffled up his hair, and at length could contain himself no longer. He bent down to Arkady and kissed him on the shoulder.
"You have made me perfectly happy," he said, without ceasing to smile. "I ought to tell you, I idolize my son. I won't even speak of my old wife, naturally a mother, but I dare not show my feelings in front of him, because he disapproves of that. He is opposed to every demonstration of emotion. Many people even find fault with him for such strength of character, and take it for a sign of pride or lack of feeling. But people like him ought not to be judged by any ordinary standards, ought they? Look at this, for example. Others in his place would have been a constant drag on their parents. But he, would you believe it, from the day he was born, he has never taken a farthing more than he could help. That's God's truth." "He is a disinterested, honest man," remarked Arkady. "Exactly so, disinterested. And I not only idolize him, Arkady Nikolaitch, I am proud of him, and the height of my only ambition is that some day there will be the following words in his biography: the son of an ordinary army doctor, who was able, however, to recognize his talent early, and spared no pains for his education." The old man's voice broke. Arkady pressed his hand. "What do you think?" inquired Vasily Ivanovich, after a short silence. "Surely he will not attain in the sphere of medicine the celebrity which you prophesy for him." "Of course, not in medicine, though even there he will be one of the leading scientific men." "In what, then, Arkady Nikolaitch?"
"It would be hard to say now, but he will be famous."
"He will be famous,"
repeated the old man, and he relapsed into thought.
"Arina Vlasyevna sent me to call you in to tea," announced Anfisushka, passing by with a huge dish of ripe raspberries.
Vasily Ivanovich started.
"And will the cream be cooled for the raspberries?"
"Yes."
"Be sure it is cold. Don't stand on ceremony. Arkady Nikolaitch, take some more. How is it Evgeny doesn't come back?"
"I'm here," called Bazarov's voice from inside Arkady's room. Vasily Ivanovich turned round quickly.
"Aha! You wanted to pay a visit to your friend. But you were too late, Amis, and we have already had a long conversation. Now we must go in to tea. Mother has sent for us. By the way, I want to have a talk with you."
"What about?"
"There's a peasant here. He's suffering from icterus."
"You mean jaundice?"
"Yes, a chronic and very obstinate case of icterus. I have prescribed him centaury and St. John's wort, told him to eat carrots, given him soda, but all those are palliative measures. We need some more radical treatment. Although you laugh at medicine, I'm sure you can give me some practical advice. But we will talk about that later. Now let us go and drink tea."
Vasily Ivanovich jumped up briskly from the garden seat and hummed the air from Robert le Diable.
The law we set ourselves, to live for pleasure."
"Astonishing vitality," observed Bazarov, moving away from the window. Midday arrived. The sun was burning from under a thin veil of unbroken whitish clouds. All was still. Only the cocks in the village broke the silence by their vigorous crowing, which produced in everyone who heard it a strange sense of drowsiness and tedium. And from somewhere high up in a treetop sounded the plaintive and persistent chirp of a young hawk. Arkady and Bazarov lay in the shade of a small haystack, and put under themselves two armfuls of rustling dry but still green and fragrant grass.
"That poplar tree," began Bazarov, "reminds me of my childhood. It grows on the edge of the pit where the brick shed used to be, and in those days I firmly believed that the poplar and the pit possessed the peculiar power of a talisman. I never felt dull when I was near them. I did not understand then that I was not dull because I was a child. Well, now I'm grown up. The talisman no longer works."
"How long did you live here altogether?" asked Arkady.
2 years on end. After that we traveled about. We led a roving life, chiefly wandering from town to town."
"And has this house been standing long?"
"Yes, my grandfather built it, my mother's father."
"Who was he, your grandfather?"
"The devil knows, some kind of second major. He served under Suvorov and always told stories about marching across the Alps. Inventions, probably."
"You have a portrait of Suvorov hanging in the drawing-room. I like such little houses as yours, old-fashioned and warm, and they always have a special kind of scent about them."
"A smell of lamp oil and clover," remarked Bazarov, yawning. "And the flies in these dear little houses. Fuh!"
"Tell me," began Arkady after a short pause, "were they strict with you as a child?"
"You see what my parents are like. They're not a severe sort."
"Are you fond of them, Evgeny?"
"I am, Arkady."
"How they adore you!"
Bazarov was silent for a while.
"Do you know what I'm thinking about?"
he said at last, clasping his hands behind his head.
"No, what is it?"
"I'm thinking how happy life is for my parents. My father, at the age of 60, can fuss around, chat about palliative measures, heal people. He plays the magnanimous master with the peasants, has a gay time, in fact. And my mother is happy, too. Her day is so crammed with all sorts of jobs, with sighs and groans, that she hasn't a moment to think about herself. While I..."
"While you?"
"While I think. Here I lie under a haystack. The tiny narrow space I occupy is so minutely small in comparison with the rest of space where I am not, and which has nothing to do with me. And the portion of time in which it is my lot to live is so insignificant beside the eternity where I have not been and will not be. And in this atom, in this mathematical point, the blood circulates, the brain works and wants something. How disgusting! How petty!"
"Allow me to point out that what you say applies generally to everyone."
"You're right," interrupted Bazarov. "I wanted to say that they, my parents, I mean, are occupied and don't worry about their own nothingness. It doesn't sicken them. While I feel nothing but boredom and anger."
"Anger? Why anger?"
"Why? How can you ask why? Have you forgotten?"
"I remember everything, but still I can't agree that you have any right to be angry. You're unhappy, I realize, but..."
"Oh, I can see, Arkady Nikolaitch, that you regard love like all modern young men. Cluck, 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 you call to the hen, and the moment the hen comes near, off you run. I'm not like that. But enough of it all. It's a shame to talk about what can't be helped."
He turned over on his side.
"Ah, there goes a brave ant dragging along a half-dead fly. Take her away, brother, take her. Don't pay any attention to her resistance. Take full advantage of your animal privilege to be without pity. Not like us self-destructive creatures."
"What are you talking about, Evgeny? When did you destroy yourself?"
Bazarov raised his head.
"That's the only thing I'm proud of. I have not crushed myself.
so a little woman can't crush me. Amen. It's all over. You won't hear another word from me about it."
Both friends lay for a time in silence.
"Yes," began Bazarov, "man is a strange animal. When one gets a side view from a distance of the dumb life our fathers lead here, one thinks, what could be better? You eat and drink and know you are acting in the most righteous and sensible way. If not, you're devoured by the tedium of it. One wants to have dealings with people, even if it's only to abuse them.
One ought to arrange one's life so that every moment of it becomes significant," remarked Arkady thoughtfully.
"I dare say. The significant may be deceptive but sweet, though it's even quite possible to put up with the insignificant. But petty squabbles, that's a misery."
"Petty squabbles don't exist for the man who refuses to recognize them as such."
"Hmm. What you have said is a commonplace turned upside down."
"What? What do you mean by that phrase?"
"I'll explain. To say, for instance, that education is beneficial, that's a commonplace. But to say that education is harmful is a commonplace turned upside down. It sounds more stylish, but fundamentally it's one and the same thing."
"But where is the truth? On which side?"
"Where? I answer you like an echo. Where?"
"You're in a melancholy mood today, Evgeny."
"Really? The sun must have melted my brain, and I ought not to have eaten so many raspberries either."
"In that case, it wouldn't be a bad plan to doze a bit," remarked Arkady.
"Certainly. Only don't look at me. Everyone has a stupid face when he's asleep."
"But isn't it all the same to you what people think of you?"
"I don't quite know how to answer you. A real man ought not to worry about such things. A real man is not meant to be thought about, but is someone who must be either obeyed or hated."
"It's odd. I don't hate anyone," observed Arkady after a pause.
"And I hate so many. You're a tender-hearted, listless creature. How could you hate anyone? You're timid. You haven't much self-reliance."
"And you," interrupted Arkady, "do you rely on yourself? Have you a high opinion of yourself?"
Bazarov paused. "When I meet a man who can hold his own beside me," he said with slow deliberation, "then I'll change my opinion of myself. Hatred. You said, for instance, today, as we passed the cottage of our bailiff Philip, the one that's so neat and clean, well, you said, Russia will achieve perfection when the poorest peasant has a house like that, and every one of us ought to help to bring it about. And I felt such a hatred for this poorest peasant, this Philip or Sidor, for whom I have to be ready to sacrifice my skin, and who won't even thank me for it. And why should he thank me? Well, suppose he lives in a clean house, while weeds grow out of me. So, what next?"
"That's enough, Evgeny. Listening to you today, one would be driven to agree with those who reproach us for absence of principles."
"You talk like your uncle. Principles don't exist in general. You haven't yet managed to understand even that much. But there are sensations. Everything depends on them."
"How is that?"
"Well, take me, for instance. I adopt a negative attitude by virtue of my sensations. I like to deny. My brain is made like that. And there's nothing more to it. Why does chemistry appeal to me? Why do you like apples? Also, by virtue of our sensations. It's all the same thing. People will never penetrate deeper than that. Not everyone would tell you so. And another time, I shouldn't tell you so myself."
"What? And is honesty also a sensation?"
"I should think so."
"Evgeny," began Arkady in a dejected tone.
"Well, what?
That's not to your taste?" broke in Bazarov.
"No, brother, if you've made up your mind to mow down everything, don't spare your own legs. But we've philosophized enough. Nature heaps up the silence of sleep," said Pushkin.
"He never said anything of the kind," retorted Arkady.
"Well, if he didn't, he might have and ought to have said it as a poet. By the way, he must have served in the army."
"Pushkin was never in the army."
"Why, on every page of his, one reads, 'To arms, for Russia's honor.' What legends you invent! Really, it's positive slander."
"Slander? There's a weighty matter.
He's found a solemn word to frighten me with. Whatever slander you may utter against a man, you may be sure he deserves 20 times worse than that in reality."
"We had better go to sleep," said Arkady with vexation.
"With the greatest of pleasure," answered Bazarov.
But neither of them slept. Some kind of almost hostile feeling had taken hold of both young men. 5 minutes later, they opened their eyes and glanced at each other in silence.
"Look," said Arkady suddenly, "a dry maple leaf has broken off and is falling to the ground. Its movements are exactly like a butterfly's flight. Isn't it strange? Such a gloomy dead thing, so like the most carefree and lively one."
"Oh, my friend Arkady Nikolaitch," exclaimed Bazarov, "one thing I implore of you, no beautiful talk."
"I talk as I best know how to. Yes, really, this is sheer despotism. A thought came into my head. Why shouldn't I express it?"
"All right, and why shouldn't I express my thoughts? I think that sort of beautiful talk is positively indecent."
"And what is decent? Abuse?"
"Ah, so I see clearly you intend to follow in your uncle's footsteps. How pleased that idiot would be if he could hear you now."
"What did you call Pavel Petrovich?"
"I called him, as he deserves to be called, an idiot."
"Really, this is unbearable," cried Arkady.
"Aha! Family feeling spoke out," remarked Bazarov coolly. "I've noticed how obstinately it clings to people. A man is ready to give up everything and break with every prejudice. But to admit, for instance, that his brother who steals other people's handkerchiefs is a thief, that's beyond his power. And as a matter of fact, to think, 'My brother, mine, and no genius,' that's more than one can swallow. A simple sense of justice spoke in me, and no family feeling at all," retorted Arkady vehemently. "But since you don't understand such a feeling, as it's not among your sensations, you're in no position to judge it. In other words, Arkady Kirsanov is too exalted for my understanding. I bow down to him and say no more."
"That's enough, Evgeny. We shall end by quarreling."
"Ah, Arkady, do me a favor. Let's quarrel properly for once, to the bitter end, to the point of destruction.
But then perhaps we should end by..."
"By fighting?" broke in Bazarov. "Well, here in the hay, in such idyllic surroundings, far from the world and far from human eyes, it wouldn't matter. But you'd be no match for me. I'd have you by the throat at once."
Bazarov stretched out his long, tough fingers.
Arkady turned round and prepared, as if joking, to resist. But his friend's face struck him as so sinister, he saw such a grim threat in the crooked smile which twisted his lips, in his glaring eyes, that he felt instinctively taken aback.
"So that is where you have got to," said the voice of Vasily Ivanovitch at this moment,
and the old army doctor appeared before the young men, dressed in a homemade linen jacket with a straw hat, also homemade, on his head.
"I've been looking for you everywhere. But you've picked out a splendid place, and you're perfectly employed. Lying on the earth and gazing up to heaven. Do you know, there's a special significance in that?"
"I gaze up to heaven only when I want to sneeze," growled Bazarov,
and turning to Arkady, he added in an undertone, "A pity he interrupted us."
"Well, that's enough,"
whispered Arkady, and secretly squeezed his friend's hand. But no friendship can withstand such shocks for long.
"I look at you, my youthful friends," said Vasily Ivanovitch meanwhile, shaking his head and leaning his folded arms on a skillfully bent stick which he himself had carved with a Turk's figure for a knob.
"I look, and I can't refrain from admiration. You have so much strength, such youthful bloom, abilities, and talents. Truly, a Castor and Pollux."
"Get along with you, shooting off into mythology," said Bazarov. "You can see he was a Latin scholar in his day. Why, I seem to remember, you won the silver medal for Latin composition, didn't you?"
"The Dioscuri, the Dioscuri," repeated Vasily Ivanovitch.
"Come, stop that, father. Don't go sentimental."
"Just once in an age, surely it's permissible," murmured the old man.
"Anyhow, I have not been searching for you, gentlemen, in order to pay you compliments, but in order to tell you, in the first place, that we shall soon be dining. And secondly, I want to warn you, Evgeny, you are a sensible man. You know the world, and you know what women are, and therefore you will excuse. Your mother wanted a service held for you in Thanksgiving for your arrival. Don't imagine that I'm asking you to attend that service. It's already over. But Father Alexei..."
"The parson?"
"Well, yes, the priest. He is to dine with us. I did not expect this, and was not even in favor of it. But somehow it turned out like that. He misunderstood me. And, well, Arina Vlasyevna. Besides, he's a worthy and reasonable man."
"I suppose he won't eat my share at dinner?" inquired Bazarov.
Vasily Ivanovitch laughed.
"The things you say!"
"Well, I ask nothing more. I'm ready to sit down at table with anyone." Vasily Ivanovitch set his hat straight.
"I was sure in advance," he said, "that you were above all such prejudices. Here am I, an old man of 62, and even I have none."
Vasily Ivanovitch dared not confess that he had himself wanted the Thanksgiving service. He was no less devout than his wife.
"And Father Alexei very much wanted to make your acquaintance. You will like him, you'll see. He doesn't mind playing cards even, and he sometimes, but this is between ourselves, goes so far as to smoke a pipe."
"Fancy that! We'll have a round of whist after dinner, and I'll beat him."
"Ha, ha, ha! We shall see. That's an open question."
"Well, won't it remind you of old times?" said Bazarov, with a peculiar emphasis.
Vasily Ivanovitch's bronzed cheeks blushed with confusion.
"For shame, Evgeny! Let bygones be bygones. Well, I'm ready to confess before this gentleman. I had that very passion in my youth, and how I paid for it, too. But how hot it is! May I sit down with you? I hope I shan't be in your way."
"Not in the least," answered Arkady. Vasily Ivanovitch lowered himself, sighing, into the hay.
"Your present quarters, my dear sirs," he began, "remind me of my military bivouacking existence. The halts of the field hospital, somewhere like this under a haystack. And even for that we thanked God."
He sighed.
"What a lot I've experienced in my time. For instance, if you allow me,
I will tell you a curious episode about the plague in Bessarabia."
"For which you won the Vladimir Cross?" interposed Bazarov. "We know, we know. By the way, why aren't you wearing it?"
"Why, I told you that I have no prejudices," muttered Vasily Ivanovich.
Only the evening before he had had the red ribbon unpicked from his coat. And he started to tell his story about the plague.
"Why, he has fallen asleep," he whispered suddenly to Arkady,
pointing to Evgeny, and winked good-naturedly.
"Evgeny, get up," he added loudly. "Let's go in to dinner."
Father Alexei, a handsome, stout man, with thick, carefully combed hair, with an embroidered belt around his mauve silk cassock, appeared to be a very skillful and adaptive person. He made haste to be the first to offer his hand to Arkady and Bazarov, as though realizing in advance that they did not want his blessing, and in general he behaved without constraint. He neither betrayed his own opinions nor provoked the other members of the company. He made an appropriate joke about seminary Latin, and stood up in defense of his bishop. He drank two glasses of wine, and refused a third. He accepted a cigar from Arkady, but did not smoke it on the spot, saying he would take it home with him. Only he had a somewhat unpleasant habit of raising his hand from time to time, slowly and carefully, to catch the flies on his face, and sometimes managing to squash them. He took his seat at the green card table with a measured expression of satisfaction, and ended by winning from Bazarov 2.5 rubles in notes. They had no idea of how to reckon in silver in Arina Vlasyevna's house. She sat, as before, close to her son. She did not play cards, and as before, she leaned her cheek on her little clenched hand. She got up only to order some fresh sweetmeat to be served. She was afraid to caress Bazarov, and he gave her no encouragement, for he did nothing to invite her caresses. And besides, Vasily Ivanovich had advised her not to disturb him too much.
"Young men are not fond of that sort of thing," he explained to her.
There is no need to say what dinner was like that day. Timofeich in person had galloped off at dawn to procure some special Circassian beef. The bailiff had gone off in another direction for turbot, perch, and crayfish. For mushrooms alone, the peasant woman had been paid 42 kopecks in copper. But Arina Vlasyevna's eyes, looking steadfastly at Bazarov, expressed not devotion and tenderness alone, for sorrow was visible in them also, mingled with curiosity and fear, and with a trace of humble reproachfulness. Bazarov, however, was in no state of mind to analyze the exact expression of his mother's eyes. He seldom turned to her, and then only with some short question. Once he asked her for her hand, for luck. She quietly placed her soft little hand on his rough, broad palm.
"Well," she asked, after waiting for a time, "did it help?"
"Worse luck than before," he answered with a careless smile. "He plays too rashly," pronounced Father Alexei, as it were compassionately, and stroked his handsome beard.
"That was Napoleon's principle, good father, Napoleon's," interposed Vasily Ivanovich, leading with an ace.
"But it brought him to the Isle of St. Helena," observed Father Alexei, and trumped his ace.
"Wouldn't you like some black currant tea, Anyushka?" asked Arina Vlasyevna.
Bazarov merely shrugged his shoulders.
"No," he said to Arkady the following day, "I go away from here tomorrow. I'm bored. I want to work, but I can't here. I will come again to your place. I left all my apparatus there. In your house, at least, one can shut oneself up. But here, my father keeps on repeating to me,
"My study is at your disposal. Nobody shall interfere with you. And all the time he himself is hardly two steps away. And I'm ashamed somehow to shut myself away from him. It's the same thing with my mother. I hear how she sighs on the other side of the wall, and then, if one goes in to see her, one has nothing to say."
"She will be most upset," said Arkady, "and so will he."
"I shall come back to them."
"When?"
"Well, when I'm on my way to Petersburg."
"I feel particularly sorry for your mother."
"How's that? She has won your heart with her raspberries?"
Arkady lowered his eyes.
"You don't understand your mother, Evgeny. She's not only a very good woman, she's really very wise. This morning she talked to me for half an hour, and so interestingly, so much to the point."
"I suppose she was expatiating about me the whole time?"
"We didn't talk about you only."
"Maybe as an outsider you see more. If a woman can keep up a conversation for half an hour, it's already a good sign. But I'm going away all the same."
"It won't be easy for you to break the news to them. They are making plans for us a fortnight ahead."
"No, it won't be easy. Some devil drove me to tease my father today. He had one of his rent-paying peasants flogged the other day, and quite rightly, too. Yes, yes, don't look at me in such horror. He did right, because that peasant is a frightful thief and drunkard. Only my father had no idea that I, as they say, became aware of the facts. He was very much embarrassed, and now I shall have to upset him as well. Never mind, he'll get over it."
Bazarov said, "Never mind," but the whole day passed before he could bring himself to tell Vasily Ivanovitch about his decision. At last, when he was just saying good night to him in the study, he remarked with a strained yawn,
"Oh, yes, I almost forgot to tell you. Will you send to Fedot's for our horses tomorrow?"
Vasily Ivanovitch was dumbfounded.
"Is Mr. Kirsanov leaving us, then?"
"Yes, and I'm going with him."
Vasily Ivanovitch almost reeled over.
"You are going away?"
"Yes, I must. Make the arrangements about the horses, please."
"Very good. To the posting station. Very good, only why is it?"
"I must go to stay with him for a short time. Afterwards I will come back here again."
"Ah, for a short time. Very good."
Vasily Ivanovitch took out his handkerchief, and as he blew his nose, bent himself almost double to the ground.
"All right, it will all be done. I had thought you were going to stay with us a little longer. 3 days? After 3 years, that's rather little, Evgeny."
"But I tell you I'm coming back soon. I have to go."
"You have to... well, duty comes before everything else. So you want the horses sent? All right. Of course, Anna and I never expected this. She has just managed to get some flowers from a neighbor. She wanted to decorate your room."
Vasily Ivanovitch did not even mention that every morning, the moment it was light, he consulted with Timofeich, and standing with his bare feet in slippers, pulling out with trembling fingers one crumpled ruble note after another, entrusted him with various purchases, particularly of good things to eat, and of red wine, which, as far as he could observe, the young men liked extremely.
"Liberty is the main thing. That is my principle. One has no right to interfere. No..."
He suddenly fell silent and made for the door.
"We shall soon see each other again, Father, really."
But Vasily Ivanovitch did not turn around.
He only waved his hand and went out. When he got back to the bedroom, he found his wife in bed and began to say his prayers in a whisper in order not to wake her up. She woke, however.
"Is that you, Vasily Ivanovitch?" she asked.
"Yes, little mother."
"Have you come from Enyusha? Do you know, I'm afraid he may not be comfortable on that sofa. I told Anfisushka to put out for him your traveling mattress and the new pillows. I should have given him our feather bed, but I seem to remember he doesn't like sleeping soft."
"Never mind, little mother, don't you worry. He's all right. Lord, have mercy on us sinners," he continued his prayer in a low voice. Vasily Ivanovitch felt sorry for his old wife. He did not wish to tell her overnight what sorrow there was in store for her. Bazarov and Arkady left on the following day. From early morning the house was filled with gloom. Anfisushka let the dishes slip out of her hand. Even Fedka became bewildered and at length took off his boots. Vasily Ivanovitch fussed more than ever. Obviously he was trying to make the best of it, talked loudly and stamped his feet, but his face looked haggard and he continually avoided looking his son in the eyes. Arina Vlasyevna wept quietly. She would have broken down and lost all control of herself if her husband had not spent 2 whole hours exhorting her early that morning. When Bazarov, after repeating promises to come back within a month at the latest, tore himself at last from the embrace detaining him and took his seat on the tarantass, when the horses started, the bell rang and the wheels were moving, and when it was no longer any use gazing after them, when the dust had settled down, and Timofeich, all bent and tottering as he walked, had crept back to his little room, when the old people were left alone in the house, which also seemed to have suddenly shrunk and grown decrepit, Vasily Ivanovitch, who a few moments before had been heartily waving his handkerchief on the steps, sank into a chair and his head fell on his breast.
"He has abandoned us, cast us off," he muttered. "Abandoned us. He only feels bored with us now. Alone, all alone, like a solitary finger," he repeated several times, stretching out his hand with the forefinger standing out from the others.
Then Arina Vlasyevna came up to him, and leaning her gray head against his gray head, she said,
"What can we do, Vasya? A son is a piece broken off. He's like a falcon that flies home and flies away again when it wants. But you and I are like mushrooms growing in the hollow of a tree. We sit side by side without moving from the same place. Only I will never change for you, and you will always be the same for me."
Vasily Ivanovitch took his hands from his face and embraced his wife, his friend, more warmly than he had ever embraced her in his youth. She comforted him in his sorrow. End of chapter 21. Recording by Roger Moline. Chapter 22 of Fathers and Sons. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Roger Moline. Fathers and Sons by Ivan Turgenev. Translated by Richard Hare. Chapter 22. In silence, only rarely exchanging a few words, our friends traveled as far as Fedot's. Bazarov was not altogether pleased with himself, and Arkady was displeased with him. He also felt gripped by that melancholy without a cause, which only very young people experience. The coachman changed the horses, and getting up on the box inquired,
"To the right or to the left?"
Arkady shuddered. The road to the right led to the town,
and from there home. The road to the left led to Madame Odintsov's place. He looked at Bazarov. "Evgeny?" he asked. "To the left?" Bazarov turned away. "What folly is this?" he muttered. "I know it is folly," answered Arkady. "But what harm does it do? It's not for the first time." Bazarov pulled his cap down over his forehead. "As you like," he said at last. "Turn to the left," shouted Arkady. The tarantass rolled off in the direction of Nikolska. But having decided on committing the folly, the friends maintained an even more obstinate silence than before, and seemed positively bad-tempered. Already, by the manner in which the butler met them in the porch of Madame Odintsov's house, the friends could guess that they had acted injudiciously in giving way so suddenly to a passing caprice. They were obviously not expected. They sat for quite a long time in the drawing-room with rather stupid faces. At length Madame Odintsov came in to them. She greeted them with her usual politeness, but showed surprise at their rapid return, and judging by the deliberation of her gestures and words, she was not over-pleased about it. They hastened to explain that they had only called there on their way, and within 4 hours must continue their journey to the town. She confined herself to a mild exclamation, asked Arkady to convey her greetings to his father, and sent for her aunt. The princess appeared, looking half asleep, which gave her wrinkled old face an even more hostile expression. Katya was unwell and did not leave her room. Arkady suddenly realized that he was at least as anxious to see Katya as to see Anna Sergeyevna herself. The 4 hours passed in small talk about one thing or another. Anna Sergeyevna both listened and talked without smiling. It was only when they were already saying good-bye that her former friendliness seemed somehow to light up again in her. "I have an attack of spleen just now," she said. "But don't pay any attention to that, and come here again—I say that to both of you—before long." Both Bazarov and Arkady responded with a silent bow, took their seats in the carriage, and without stopping again anywhere, drove straight home to Marino, where they arrived safely on the evening of the following day. During the whole journey neither of them so much as mentioned the name of Madame Odintsov. Bazarov, in particular, hardly opened his mouth, and kept staring sideways at the road with a kind of embittered concentration. At Marino everyone was overjoyed to see them. The prolonged absence of his son had begun to make Nikolai Petrovitch uneasy. He uttered a joyful exclamation and bounced up and down on the sofa, dangling his legs, when Fenichka ran into him with sparkling eyes and announced the arrival of the young gentleman. Even Pavel Petrovitch felt to some degree pleasantly excited, and smiled indulgently as he shook hands with the returned wanderers. Talk and questions followed quickly. Arkady talked most, especially at supper, which lasted till long after midnight. Nikolai Petrovitch ordered up some bottles of porter which had just been brought from Moscow, and he himself made merry till his cheeks turned purple, laughing repeatedly with a rather childlike but nervous laughter. Even the servants were affected by the general gaiety. Dunyasha ran up and down like one possessed, slamming doors from time to time, while Pyotr, at 3 o'clock in the morning, was still trying to play a Cossack waltz on the guitar. The strings emitted their sweet and plaintive sounds in the motionless air, but except for some short preliminary flourishes, the cultured valet's efforts failed to produce any tune. Nature had granted him no more talent for music than it had for anything else. But meanwhile things had not been going too well at Marino, and poor Nikolai Petrovitch was having a hard time. Every day difficulties arose on the farm, senseless, distressing difficulties.
the troubles with the hired laborers had become intolerable. Some gave notice or asked for higher wages, while others walked off with wages they had received in advance. The horses fell sick. The harness was damaged as though it had been burnt. The work was carelessly done. A threshing machine ordered from Moscow turned out to be unusable because it was too heavy. Another winnowing machine was ruined the very first time it was used. Half the cattle sheds were burned down because a blind old woman on the farm went with a blazing firebrand in windy weather to fumigate her cow. Of course, the old woman maintained that the whole mishap was due to the master's plan of introducing new-fangled cheeses and dairy products. The bailiff suddenly turned lazy and began to grow fat, as every Russian grows fat when he gets an easy living. When he caught sight of Nikolai Petrovich in the distance, he would try to demonstrate his zeal by throwing a stick at a passing pig, or by threatening some half-naked ragamuffin, but for the rest of the time he was generally asleep. The peasants who had been put on the rent system did not pay in time and stole wood from the forest. Almost every night the watchmen caught peasants' horses in the farm meadows and sometimes removed them after a scrimmage. Nikolai Petrovich would fix a money fine for damages, but the matter usually ended by the horses being returned to their owners after they had been kept for a day or two on the master's forage. On top of all this, the peasants began to quarrel among themselves. Brothers asked for their property to be divided. Their wives could not get on together in one house. Suddenly a quarrel would flare up. They would all rise to their feet, as though at a given signal, would run to the porch of the estate office, and crawl in front of the master, often in a drunken state with battered faces, demanding justice and retribution. An uproar and clamor would ensue, the shrill screams of the women mingling with the curses of the men. The contending parties had to be examined, and one had to shout oneself hoarse, knowing in advance that it was in any case quite impossible to reach a just settlement. There were not enough hands for the harvest. A neighboring yeoman, in the most benevolent manner, contracted to supply him with reapers for a commission of 2 rubles per acre, and cheated him in the most shameless way. His peasant women demanded exorbitant prices, and meanwhile the corn got spoiled. The harvest was not in the common ownership, but at the same time the Council of Guardians issued threats and demanded immediate and full payment of interest due.
"It's beyond my power," exclaimed Nikolai Petrovich several times in despair. "I can't flog them myself. To send for the police is against my principles, but without the fear of punishment you can do absolutely nothing with them."
"Do calm, do calm," Pavel Petrovich would remark on these occasions, but he hummed to himself, frowned, and twisted his mustache. Bazarov held himself aloof from all the squabbles, and indeed, as a guest, it was not incumbent on him to meddle in other people's affairs. On the day after his arrival in Maryino, he set to work on his frogs, his infusoria, and his chemical experiments, and spent all his time over them. Arkady, on the contrary, considered it his duty, if not to help his father, at least to create an impression of being ready to help him. He listened to him patiently, and sometimes gave his advice, not that he expected it to be acted upon, but in order to show his concern. The details of agricultural management were not repugnant to him. He even indulged in pleasant dreams about agricultural work, but at this time his mind was preoccupied with other ideas. To his own surprise, Arkady found he was thinking incessantly of Nikolska. Formerly he would have just shrugged his shoulders if anyone had told him he could feel bored under the same roof as Bazarov, particularly in his own home. But now he was bored and longed to get away.
He tried walking till he was tired out, but that did not help either. One day, when talking to his father, he found out that Nikolai Petrovich possessed a number of quite interesting letters, written to his wife by Madame Odintsov's mother, and Arkady gave him no peace until he had taken out the letters, for which Nikolai Petrovich was obliged to rummage in 20 different drawers and boxes. Having gained possession of these crumbling papers, Arkady somehow calmed down as if he had secured a clearer vision of the goal towards which he ought now to move. "I say that to both of you," he kept on repeating to himself. "Those were the words she added. I shall go there. I shall go. Hang it all." Then he recalled his last visit, the cold reception and his previous embarrassment, and shyness overwhelmed him. But the adventurous daring of youth, the secret desire to try his luck, to test his powers independently without anyone else's protection, prevailed at last. Before 10 days had passed after his return to Marino, on the pretext of going to study the organization of Sunday schools, he galloped off again to the town, and from there on to Nikolsko. Uninterruptedly urging the driver forward, he dashed on like a young officer riding into battle. He felt at once frightened and light-hearted, and breathless with impatience. "The main thing is, I mustn't think," he kept on saying to himself. His driver happened to be a high-spirited fellow, who stopped in front of every inn and exclaimed, "A drink?" or, "What about a drink?" But, to make up for that, after the drink he did not spare his horses. At length there came into sight the high roof of the familiar house. "What shall I do?" suddenly flashed through Arkady's mind. "Anyhow, I can't turn back now." The three horses sped gaily on. The driver yelled and whistled at them. Already the little bridge was echoing under the wheels and the horses' hoofs, and the avenue of lopped pines was drawing nearer. He caught a glimpse of a woman's pink dress moving among the dark green trees, and a young face peeped out from under the light fringe of a parasol. He recognized Katya, and she recognized him. Arkady ordered the driver to stop the galloping horses, jumped out of the carriage, and went up to her. "It's you," she murmured, and slowly blushed all over. "Let us go to my sister. She's here in the garden. She will be pleased to see you." Katya led Arkady into the garden. His meeting with her struck him as a particularly happy omen. He was delighted to see her, as though she were someone close to his heart. Everything had happened so agreeably. No butler, no formal announcement. At a turn in the path, he caught sight of Anna Sergeyevna. She was standing with her back to him. Hearing his footsteps, she gently turned around. Arkady would have felt embarrassed again, but the first words which she uttered immediately set him at ease. "Welcome, you runaway!" she said in her smooth, caressing voice, and came forward to meet him, smiling and screwing up her eyes from the sun and breeze. "Where did you find him, Katya?"
"I have brought you something, Anna Sergeyevna," he began, "which you certainly don't expect."
"You have brought yourself. That's better than anything else."
End of chapter 22. Recording by Roger Moline.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed-sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. and listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.